Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
It's a new year, and you want to keep growing your team, but you need the right tools to help you keep you streamlined and efficient. That's where ZipRecruiter.com/murder comes in. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire. Good evening. The Gwinnett County, Georgia Police Department was formed by tough, honorable men who were brought in to clean up the county after the sheriff made moonshining his personal business. With a low budget, officers had to buy their own uniforms, guns, even bullets. The police had to take anyone with a pulse who could stand upright. Even with the odds against them, the police department grew into a force feared by the criminals and respected by county citizens. Late one night in spring of 1964, the police in Gwinnett County and everywhere learned just how far that respect would go in saving their lives in a tight spot. Officers Jesse Gravett, Ralph Davis, and Jerry Everett responded to a report of suspicious activity on a desolate county road named Ark. What they found was a kind of criminal they were completely unprepared for, a psychopath who would do anything to avoid the consequences of his actions, including the cold-blooded killing of three county police officers. This began one of the most intense murder investigations that Georgia had ever seen. Ark Road is the story of those officers, that investigation, and the fallout from those horrific murders that changed the way law enforcement officers are trained. Ark Road, the horrific murders of three police officers in Gwinnett County, Georgia, that changed law enforcement forever. With my special guest, journalist and author Tony Tiffin. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Tony Tiffin.
Dan, it's my pleasure. Greetings from the Deep South, though it's a bit cold here today.
Ah, yes, from Georgia.
From Georgia. I mean, the land of Georgia. Dan, let me inform you and your readers there, it's okay to chuckle. The reason is this story and all of its horror is laughable in certain areas now still, but not to worry. We're all cried out down here. That story 55 years later is still causing a sadness that has broken Gwinnett County's heart and will always be a dark chapter. In fact, they call the weekend of the murders and their funerals as the dark days of Gwinnett County. It still holds over us, probably always will.
Tell us about Gwinnett County and your connection to this area of the Old South in Georgia. Tell us about the early 60s, before preceding 1964 in April, when this occurred. Tell us a little bit about Gwinnett County, Georgia, and the surrounding little towns around it. Tell us what it was like and where its proximity to.
Gwinnett County is just north, and it's in the five metro county metropolis of Atlanta, Georgia. We're just northeast of Atlanta. In the early 60s, Gwinnett County was fourth in population in the metro area, and it was number one in land mass thereabouts. 470 square miles of chicken farms, dirt roads, and cotton fields. It was agriculture. It was some ranching going on, but mostly chickens. And it was still a very quiet, deep south traditional county where not much had grabbed hold. But like all of Atlanta, that was soon to change. But Gwinnett County was farmers, desolate in many ways, but the dirt roads were like spider webs, went throughout the county. And as a result, folks kind of lived on their own. In the case of Ark Road in the early 60s, Ark Road was a two-mile-long stretch of road, but only two residents were along the entire two-mile stretch. So we were desolate, and we were kind of quiet, yet we could get to Atlanta, downtown Atlanta, within generally an hour's drive until the road started improving. Then we could get down there in 20 minutes. But until then, we were a county all to ourselves, formed really as little Indian reservations, which had sprung up along the Chattahoochee River. And from there, we grew into little small towns and had at that time and have always had an Indian kind of a tradition about us. We still celebrate Indian holidays and things of that nature. But it was a mixture. It was the Deep South. It was the Old South. And not a whole lot went on outside of your little neighborhood. So we were self-sufficient people that usually had our own little gardens and our own little plots and so on and so forth. We're all saying back then, if you wanted to eat, you either had to grow it or slaughter it, one, to get food on your table, and that's pretty much the way we live. Food was a priority, shelter was a priority, family and God were right up there at the top of the list. In no specific order, each having equal measure.
You talk about the history also of the liquor stills, and also that it became a political issue and leading to there a desire to form a proper police department. So tell us about this, a little bit about this liquor history and the politics behind the move for a new police department.
Well, sure. It's your listeners know it's moonshine because it traveled in tanks hidden under old Ford coupes by the light of the moon back in that day. So that was just the culture of the Deep South, Dan. That's what we did in our own kind of way. You have to try and put yourself back in the early 60s and just prior, but throughout the mid 60s as well. When you wanted something from your general store, and that's what it was, a general store, generally a two-mile hike to get to it, trading was okay with folks. We would take a chicken down there, and usually a live chicken would get you a bag of candy, a Coca-Cola, and a pack of cigarettes. We just did buy our own resources. And moonshining was just an old traditional thing that the boys up in the hills, better known as hillbillies, that's what they did, but we didn't see any harm in it. Though it was one of those major platforms or major stumps that the politicians would come through here and throw at us as if we were appreciating what they were saying. Well, we didn't appreciate it at all. That's why in 1960, we hired the biggest still owner and elected him as our new high sheriff. So we were tired of empty promises and things of that nature. The old saying was, you could drive a car at the speed limit down a dirt road, throw a rock out of the driver's window, and chances are it would clank when it would hit the ground because it would hit a still. It wasn't that prevalent, but it was a loose kind of society where gambling parlors, keeping in mind, though, the irony of it all was Gwinnett was a dry county at the time. If you wanted to buy a liquor, buy a drink, you'd have to go into the city of Atlanta. So we just did what we wanted to do and got around, and it was people used Gwinnett County to satisfy desires one way or another. And so we had the gambling parlors, the shot houses, the moonshine. But a lot of the moonshine that was made around here was either for self-consumption or they'd pack it into the back of that old Ford and send it down to Atlanta and points actually further, because here in the North Georgia area where Ark Road took place, is hills and woods and streams. perfect ingredient for hauling a couple of old drums up into the woods and start a fire. And our all saying was back then, good liquor comes, starts with a blue flame. So we just had a good time doing that and using our own resources to make moonshine. But it was not like everybody was falling over drunk on illegal liquor. That didn't happen at all.
Let's get to the police commissioner and who he heads up in his new department. Tell us about this personnel that he assembles to be able to clean up this area.
Well, the police department and the sheriff's department were totally different departments. The police department came on because the commissioners decided we got ourselves into a mess here. We've gotten a history and now one of the biggest culprits of all time elected as our sheriff. So we need, the commissioners came about saying we need to not elect, but rather appoint chief of police and start a new police department independent of that bunch over there in the sheriff's department. The sheriff had come in, as I said, the biggest still owner in the county. So it didn't take. Also keep in mind, Dan, before I get too far ahead of myself, that the police department started with only two patrol officers. The sheriff's department right. never had much more than about six or eight deputies, but they were of the our new high sheriff's making. They did what he said to do, and when they couldn't get paid or anything for that, he explained, well, you make your money out there on those roads. The police commissioner came in to attempt at bringing about law and order into the county with the new police department and the integrity of those he first brought into, such as Chief of Police J.O. Bell, M.J. Puckett, those guys, assistant chief of police, were honorable men. They were upstanding characters. They believed in one thing, and that was the peace and quality and the growth of Gwinnett County in their own way. And they went on to hire up a few more boys, but the police department was not a glamorous job by any means. They would go for it to be glamorous, but they only paid the patrol officers $200 a month. They didn't give them any of their own equipment. They didn't provide them anything that they needed. So the police officer, if he joined the force, and not a whole lot came busting down the old jailhouse door to get onto the force, they had to buy their own uniforms, their own guns, their own boots, their own bullets. And it was a very tough beginning. In fact, it was not the first time that the county had tried a police department. It was rather the second time. The first time had failed. They just couldn't get any officers to do the trick.
Now, you talk about that you introduce characters that they hire in this small force. Leonard Bowen, they call him the Bull. They also get another tough guy named Jerry Everett. A little bit later, they're looking around. I mean, like you say, nobody's really dying to be a police officer there, but they find a guy that actually had a self-defense manslaughter charge and prison term, this Ralph Davis. And then Carl Gravett and his brother Jesse applied. So this is where we are introduced to Ralph Davis, Jesse Gravett, and Jerry Everett in this new police force.
Let me get ahead of you a little bit. The whole point of Ark Road is never forget those names, so I appreciate very much you bringing their names up. The new police force was, you mentioned it earlier, Mr. Bowen. The tough guys, you called them, you addressed them Mr. Mr. Bowen, as I say, best not mess with the old Georgia boy, goes with the nickname Bull. He got the job done whenever he needed to. Jerry Everett was came from a family of police officers, was a smart officer, started at a young age, and by the time he was 28 years of age in 1964, he had already gone through just about anything a Gwinnett cop could go through. That day and time, there were no radios, that almost line of sight, if you will. There was no backup. A police officer, whatever he got into, he had to get himself out of, and it was up to him. Gwinnett, when they first started the police department, they did partner up, so they had two per patrol car with a total of eight patrol officers and four cars. But if you got yourself into trouble, and believe me, in North Georgia, especially Gwinnett County, you could easily get yourself in trouble. There were those out there that just did not have any respect for lawmen. A police officer was not a friendly guy. So you had a mixture of characters in the county, those that never interacted with the police, those that from time to time would get a ticket, and those that were out to do anything against the police that they possibly could. But back in those days, they had no training. They had nothing to go along with. So it was a personal reward that the police officers got. But you mentioned their names. They're very real. Those people, the names are not changed in this book. Those are real characters from Gwinnett County back in the 60s.
Now, you set the stage here that it's a little humble little force that's been together for a few years, that's been assembled. They're tough guys in a tough area and people interacting people look the other way for many, what some people would say victimless crimes, but at least crimes are looked the other way. So the police have their hands full and they're in an unthankful position. Tell us about what Ark Road is and tell us about the call that comes in and why and how and who and how Davis and Everett's car is sent on this call.
Ark Road is the culmination of what law enforcement was in the country at that time, certainly throughout Georgia. Atlanta and Fulton County, they had a much larger force. But Gwinnett County being, again, that it was so rural that it was just experimenting with this new force. I think day to day they were probably hoping that they would wake up and still have jobs tomorrow morning. Ark Road came about as an area. It was just a thorough road from Beaver Ruin to Pleasant Hill. It was a 2-mile-long stretch of a dirt road, and it wasn't very well maintained, so it was a tough road to get across. In fact, I've had many people tell me back in the Ark Road day they could not drive their passenger car the full length of Ark Road. It was just too rutty and too narrow and just unimproved, to say the least. But it is the story about, in that day, Dan, you have to understand also, and these are tough things to do because we're talking over half a century to go, but the police officers in that day with no training, they really weren't emphasized, it wasn't emphasized upon the citizens that we had a police force to answer to the call of to the bad guys, because there weren't that many bad guys there. Today, it's a different world. If you open up the newspapers, you're going to see murders and you're going to see robbery and ID theft. And, you know, well, there wasn't any of that in Gwinnett County, hardly back in there. So our police officers didn't have to go around investigating crimes of murder. In fact, it was because of this inexperience that brought in outside forces when this happened. But even in today's time, we hear about police officers being murdered all the time. But even today, it would be a shocker, I dare say, if someone was to wake up and read the headline that 3 county police officers were marched into the woods, handcuffed, the 3 of them together, and shot the guns, their 3 guns used to kill them, with 16 rounds finding their mark in the officers' heads. That would be an alarm even today's time. So imagine the ripple. First of all, the lightning bolt that penetrated everybody in this county because we knew those 3 police officers. But then the ripple effect it had, not just in Georgia, but there were people in Stockholm reading the headlines the next day in their newspaper. Locally here, or I should say in the States, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, all heard about it that night. All 3, at that time there were 3 networks on TV, the Walter Cronkites, the Brinkleys, so on and so forth, that reported it that evening, April the 17th, 1964, and it led their televised news. Of course, here in Atlanta, it was just unbelievable. We just couldn't believe. I came about in this story. My dad was a military police officer who died while active duty, and that was in Massachusetts. We followed the casket down here to Atlanta, and next thing I know is I'm living as a 10-year-old kid here in Atlanta for several years when this incident took place. And it reminded me, it reeled me back to my dad saying, if you're ever in trouble or you need help, seek out the nearest police officer. So when I read those headlines, and of course on the Atlanta news, it was everywhere, I could not believe that someone would not just hurt a police officer, but murder a police officer, and not just one, but three together. So on April the 17th, early in the morning, they were found off of Ark Road to the side in a stretch of woods that they could not see from the little road itself until they started walking around the woods, and then they finally saw the three corpses lying on the ground in the woods, handcuffed together, and virtually a pool of blood, floating in a pool of blood.
You mentioned that a man named A.C. Mills, virtually there's no houses on this Ark Road, but somebody, again, very timely, had a dog barking. And so this A.C. Mills, an old man, calls the police and says, there's some boys up here that shouldn't be up here. It's 1:30 in the morning, and there shouldn't be anybody here, and maybe come up and investigate. So they send a dispatcher named Pruitt sends Davis and Everett's car. So what do police know after they find this horror scene? They also find a smoldering 63 Oldsmobile. Tell us about that. What do police know, and how do they proceed from there? Of course, they're outraged. They want to capture these criminals. What do they do?
The night before, or late at night on April the 16th, before it turned the midnight onto Friday, the stars were all aligned for the heavens to fall apart. The radio operator, Pruitt, was only there by happenstance. He normally had left the jailhouse and his radio position much earlier than that. Jesse Gravitt was on the side of the expressway with Bull Bowen. They were investigating a car fire, and he had asked or requested that Car 29, Jerry Everett and Ralph Davis, come pick him up and take him to his home. They had not yet gotten this radio call from Pruitt, nor had A.C. Mills called Pruitt to complain, there's two people out on my road, two cars. They look like they're smoking cigarettes. They look like they're talking. They're right up the street from me, and there's not supposed to be anybody out here that time of night. He was correct. Ark Road was not passable at night. There were no lights, street lights. There was nothing there. It was contingent on the amount of light put out by the moon and stars, as always was. In this case, they didn't know where Ark Road was. There was no GPS on the car. So as they were taking Mr. Gravitt home that night, Jerry Everett, driving car 29, happened to see an old wooden sign that had inscribed on it, Ark. And so he turned down that from the other side from which the bad guys and Mr. Mills came in. Mr. Mills lived on the what we call the south end of the road. It is divided by a creek, and then there's the north end of the road, and at the time that creek had a small rickety bridge crossing it. Patrol car 29 came from the north entrance, and as they came up over the hill on Ark Road, almost to the completion of Ark Road, there they saw them. If it was 10 minutes either way, perhaps they wouldn't have. The Truett, Williams, and Evans, the bad guys, would have been gone in 10 minutes. And none of this would have happened, but it just continued all the things that would occur. Also, just more irony happened. Jerry Everett had just bought what is now described as a backup gun, and he had it in his pocket. But just moments before they got the call to go pick up Mr. Gravitt, Jerry had unloaded his Derringer and handed it to Walt Tongue, who Mr. Tongue had a diner, and they were having their midnight meal there. When he unloaded that Derringer, Ralph Davis came running into the diner, said, we've got to pick up Mr. Gravitt. Jerry grabbed the gun from Walt, but he did not reload the single bullet he had in his pocket. Things would have been totally different had that call not come in, because Pruitt wasn't on the phone. Had Mr. Mills' dog, Count, not barked all night to keep them awake? Had these guys not chosen Ark Road to take the license and registration off of the stolen car and then move it on for things they were going to do with it later? All of these things, just if one could not have happened without the other. But because they all happened together, we ended up with three of our better county police officers in the woods and not found until 12 hours or thereabouts later. So it was all just a matter of the planets and the stars were just out of phase that night for these three guys.
A real confluence of misadventure and horror. Right away, the police are, like I say, they're determined to find the perpetrators, and they're going to take the necessary resources, and the people are definitely have the passion to be able to do this. As you write in the book, you have a couple of officers, Cheek and Crunkleton, that are involved in this investigation, and right away they spot somebody that they know from this small community. And what does this M.C. Perry character have to say?
We go back to the day when everybody either knew everybody in the county or knew somebody that did know everybody in the county. When the Gwinnett County police officers and police chief J.O. Bell was standing over the three officers in the woods, he knew right away, as did everybody in Gwinnett County, we had no means of investigating a crime such as that. We didn't have a detective squad. We didn't have investigators. We just had a handful of patrol officers with no experience even in that phase of law enforcement, let alone investigating a triple homicide where no clues were left whatsoever at the scene. The GBI, Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and their strong arm, the Georgia State Patrol, they did patrol in that area, the highway, I-85 in that area. They had two officers that came down to the scene when Chief Bell let out a cry for help. Something's not right, but before they had discovered the bodies. So by the time they had discovered the bodies, the State Patrol already had officers here. Other little small towns already had police officers here. But it was the State Patrol officers that said they're not going to be able to solve this unless we put our finest investigators in the state has to offer in on this case, and that's what they did. From that point on, the Georgia State Patrol became the law enforcement party of all of Gwinnett. So they came in, and Gwinnett, the Gwinnett police, the Gwinnett officers, Gwinnett sheriff, every citizen in Gwinnett took a deep breath of relief the moment we knew that somebody else was investigating this crime. We couldn't do it, and it wasn't going to happen that way. So they came in, and through them, Detectives Cheek and Crunkleton came from DeKalb County. Mr. Cheek came from the Sheriff's Department. Mr. Crunkleton came from the Police Department. He was in charge of DeKalb County's vice squad. And Homer Lee Cheek was involved with the Sheriff's Department as an investigator for the sheriff. So these guys started to know what was going on. But when we ran into M.C. Perry just a few days after everybody got together and was getting over the funerals or trying to, they started perusing through Gwinnett County to the approval, to the request and approval of J.O. Bell, our police chief at the time. And it is that time, way up in the north end of the county, up in Buford, Georgia, they found M.C. Perry at Red's service station, and Detective Cheek already knew Perry and his long arrest record. So they just started asking him questions. Perry was involved in stealing cars. He had been. He'd been a punk all his life. And he told Detective Cheek indirectly things that they were able to piece together and put together, and that's where the investigation went. But I'll go back to the part, Dan, about the county being small. It wasn't very much populated. When it came to Alex Evans, the former Gwinnett County Sheriff Deputy, who was dismissed from the Sheriff Department in disgrace and would later go on to do jail time with both our ex-high sheriff for his – he got caught finally. They put that bunch in away because he was running law enforcement into the ground here. After all of that was said and done, Alex Evans was his sheriff deputy. Everybody in the county knew Alex Evans. And as a result, a lot of people from day one, all through the county, the murmurs started instantly. There's only one guy in this county capable enough to have done what he did. And again, the sadness and the entire sadness of this story is Alex Evans had patrolled with patrolman Jerry Everett and Ralph Davis, knew him well, had dinner at his house on several occasions. They were at one time good friends. He's the guy that everybody felt could have been the killer in this case, and we know how that turned out as well. But then with that lead and a couple of other good breaks in the case as far as evidence was concerned, the outside forces and eventually the Georgia Bureau of Investigation came in and solved that crime. But they knew who – there was three people involved. They knew who those three people were. There was no evidence of any kind that would allow them to go to the grand jury and get indictments for these guys, except for one of the bad guys turned state witness. And when he did, he ratted the other two guys out. And eventually, 18 months after the crime, those two were found guilty. But it was also the planets and the stars got back in line to go through the investigation and solve this crime. And that's what Georgia finally took a breath of relief about. But that's when really the sadness came back into play. But MC Perry, they were all integral. They all played important roles in not just the investigation, but their testimony, because it was the 12-man jury that they had to convince, along with Wade Truitt's testimony against his two partners. It was that 12-man jury they had to impress enough to get a conviction out of the deal is what I'm trying to say. But at any rate, they all played an integral part, but they had to piece together little pieces of this from this guy, this much from this witness, and so on and so forth, and accumulated quite a number of witnesses that they eventually brought in. The trial itself ran for 4 days each trial. There were co-trials, one for Alex Evans, the other for Vincent Eugene Williams. And those two trials, co-trials, were in October, thereabouts, of 1965. Each trial lasted 4 days. Each trial ended with a three-hour jury conviction, shall we say. It didn't take long at all to convict them, but it was proof positive. In fact, we'll talk about the research and all, but I had the great pleasure of knowing Robert Hightower for some time, and Mr. Hightower told me that there were certain things they could not have accomplished without Wade Truitt's testimony. But in this case, they got it right. And he said, Tony, back days of 60s law enforcement, we didn't always get it right. But this one we got right.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. 2 easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. My wife Lisa decided to take Ritual about 6 weeks ago. She especially liked the amount of research they did to create the Ritual vitamin. She feels very confident about their claims, and she thinks ritual has made a difference in her everyday activities. From D3 to omega-3, ritual's essential for women helps fill gaps in a woman's diet. Their no-nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach. And there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh, so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, Tony, we have to go back because we have, for the audience, skipped over some of these incredible hurdles and challenges that it seems like this open and shut case where everyone, as you mentioned, knows that this Evans is capable of something like this, a dirty cop, had no business even being a cop in the first place, as you write. They were sort of foisted on the department, and he was a crooked cop for his six-year tenure as a police officer. But this Vincent Williams, and then this Wade Truitt. Now, when you talk about, you had the privilege of talking to Robert Hightower, you talk about the investigation stalling at some point, despite everybody knowing what went on. There was no prints left. There was just the horror of these three officers being shot in the face and the head with their own revolvers and then handcuffed together in this horror spectacle for other officers to find. So tell us about Robert Hightower and his strategy, because this book is chock full of the fascinating dialogue and exchanges between police and these suspects trying to bring these people to justice.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Dan, about the dialogue, and at times it can be rather harsh. It was the folks who this story belongs to that I would pass that along, and I'd say, hey, look, some of this language is a little bit colorful. And they would say, but it's what was in the story you got to tell. So it was the family members that really told me the parameters I had to go within. And so I've had that comment. This is harsh. It is harsh because this is not a story of cupcakes and ice cream. So no. It is a dialogue that a lot of the players, of course, are long gone, but their family members told me, oh, this is what he would have said, or this is what would have happened, and so on and so forth. Mr. Hightower, Robert Hightower, was a very, very colorful, yet very strict law enforcement officer. He came with an FBI background, Washington, D.C. Metro Police. He was into the Major Crimes Unit, and he came back home to Georgia so he could be a professor at the War College in Milledgeville, and he also was involved with law enforcement, of course. The investigation had just gone stale, though they had the names of two people right from the get-go, and that was Vincent Eugene Williams and Alex Evans. Truitt's name never appeared until they started unfolding these little clues that amounted to who could have done it. So everybody was a suspect, as Alex Evans once said. But when it stalled for good. You had a very, very good GBI agent in the name of Arthur Hutchins. He was a terrific man, but he could only go so far with what he had, and they had reached a roadblock. Hightower, they invited him into the GBI headquarters in downtown Atlanta just to think he was meeting the boys. I can recall Bob telling me, Tony, they showed me this little room, and inside of it had 6 months' worth of investigation written and documented in there, some as little as on a book of matches, a name, a phone number, something. So I decided I was going to go all the way back from the very beginning and start anew, because Hightower was very impressed with the fact that this crime had stalled, but they would consider him the man to come in and save it. A lot of people's hides were on the line here because the public was still so upset about this crime and why it wasn't getting solved. So when Mr. Hightower came in, he just emptied all the files in this little office that they'd given him and started straightening the mess out, which led him to a couple of people that had not been interviewed but he felt were crucial. And he gave it a fresh angle to see this whole thing through, and then he went out and started his own investigation when he came across the name of Wade Truitt. He got that name through other people, but there was a connection between Truitt and Williams. And then Hightower would go down to the Florida State Prison, where Wade and Vincent and Alex were all doing time for a previous crime involving the hijacking of a bonded liquor truck that came through the Atlanta area back in that day. So they were doing their sentences from that conviction, and Hightower went in to interview Truitt. After he got Truitt, he said, "I don't need Vincent Williams or Alex Evans anymore," because Truitt had made a confession, and he got it. Hightower got it out of Truitt in Hightower's way of doing things, and it was quite interesting, the story he said. But he was able at that time, after Truitt's confession, and asking him very important questions that other investigators just had open answers to. They were questions that they didn't know, and that would have really put the piece of the puzzle together, such as evidence at the old crime scene that Truitt explained where Hightower would find it, out in the pasture, an old license plate, and Hightower found it, and he told me, "Tony, that proved to me that he was here at that crime scene, and that he's the guy that took that license plate off of that stolen car." And everything from that point on started to fall in play with everything he said. And Hightower played along being the nice guy with Truitt for some time, but Truitt never fouled up. He never tripped over his own words. He remained solid to his conviction that he had given Hightower, and all through about an eight-month period, he stayed right on course with that conviction. With that confession. These guys, Truitt and Williams, were just punks. They were car thieves, penny ante crooks, so on and so forth. They were not capable of murder. To get to know them, you start to understand that. They were not the two kind of guys you would want as neighbors, not even close, but they were not capable of murder. So it was only then that you have to draw a line, and let me just move ahead and tell you, this is how Hightower solved the crime. No one saw the actual murder or the mechanics of the murders of those three police officers, nor did the state of Georgia have to prove the mechanics of these murders. They just had to prove that they did in fact happen, and these are the three guys that perpetrated that murder. But when Truitt gave up his confession, for many reasons why I think your listeners would understand, it was driving him crazy, the thought of what had happened and the eventual notion that he was going to get caught. And if he got caught on his own, the chair waited for him. And so that was the whole point of Mr. Hightower's brilliance, was really he could come in there and open up a cold case and get it back on track and get enough evidence to where Mr. Merritt, the county solicitor at the time, was able to convince a grand jury, "Let's get on with these trials. These are the guys who did it."
With that confession came all kinds of evidence that had to be corroborated, and Hightower was pleased to believe that it would be corroborated, and it was. So the things he said, like where the license plate was thrown, but more importantly, he talks about his non-participation in the murder of these police officers and why that is, why he is not at the same location as they are, and what actually he does witness. So
Truitt was, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, Dan, Truett was just a puppet. He was manipulated by Evans, as was Williams. But Alex, having a previous law enforcement experience, he held the guns. When they took the three officers' guns from them and eventually would use those to kill those three officers, it was Alex Evans in control. You back up Truett's statements, and you'll put those pieces together. That's what Hightower did. He put them together. But you had 25, 30 actual witnesses come in and say a little something in each trial. They used essentially the same witnesses in the co-trials, but they used the witnesses to put together little pieces here and there that established a timeline. Who saw who where? Who was doing what and why and when and things of that nature? And because of that, they were then able to, after putting, and Hightower primarily was the one who did it, after putting everything into a specific timeline, then Hightower was able to say, okay, I know what happened. I'm going to present that evidence face-to-face to our boy Truett down in the Florida Men's State Prison down there, federal prison, and see what his expressions are. As Hightower said, I could look a man in the eye and I could tell you if he's being truthful much better than I can read it out of a second, third-hand report that came out of a file cabinet. So when he put all his files together, he put together a timeline of things of that nature, all involving this crime, then he realized, I've got them. This is them. They had all the proof, and they were able to convincingly bring that to the county solicitor and put together a case that the grand jury said go. And it was a pretty rock-solid case at that time. But it, without Robert Hightower, this crime would have never been solved. If the crime had never been solved, then we wouldn't be on this phone right now, because I did have the opportunity. I don't know if I would consider it a privilege or how I would describe it, of going to interview Alex Evans in prison. And as I spoke to him and talked to him about this case, he continuously, Georgia's longest tenured life-serving prisoner, denied to me. Alex Evans told me, Tony, I don't ever want to be paroled. Parole means that I did it and they want to get rid of me. I want to be fully pardoned, or you can take your parole and stick it. And he lived up to that. He never was paroled. He was never going to be pardoned. And that was how it went. But in talking with Alex, there were several things that he shared with me that he really didn't mean to share with me. It reached the point on a couple of three occasions where I had to say, Alex, I'm not here to interrogate you. I'm just here to talk with you. I'm going to write this book one way or another. It's going to kill me. And that was at the very outset of this journey of mine, this 10-year journey to do it. But I had the distinct pleasure of talking to, interviewing family members, and really we became such solid friends, police officers of the day, the community at large. Hey, buddy, do you remember 55 years ago was my lead-in approach. This county, and one of the reasons I was compelled to do it, couldn't live without doing it, is because I was doing a series of public information articles about county personnel. And one of the fire and emergency captains told me, if you don't write, we got to talking about it, if you don't write that book, it's going to slip away. This story is slipping away. The vast majority of residents in Gwinnett County today know nothing of this story. So it was about, and by the way, today I gladly and fondly claim that the Gwinnett County Police Department, whose roots began in those early 60s, is now one of the finest police departments in the world. You can argue with it, but you're not going to win that with me. But at any rate, it was one of those sad events. But I had, and as I mentioned earlier, we are all cried out here, Dan. This story is still stings if you get as close to it as I got, as close to it as those directly connected to it would allow me to get, and they brought me into their homes and shared their hearts with me because they wanted this story told as well. But this story was slipping away. Actually, it had slipped away right as I got into it because the autopsy reports and the investigative reports that were held in the vault of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation managed, after they made me copies of everything they had, the room where those archives were kept was gutted out, and none of those documents are any longer available. So the timing for me was just the opposite as it was for officers Everett, Gravett, and Davis on that night. I got very, very lucky, and it because of that, because this story was just on the verge of being a puff of smoke in history, I felt I had to do something about it. And it was, again, Robert Hightower passed away about halfway through this book as I was writing it. And though it was that 10-year misery, sleepless nights, many a sunrise where I never intended on watching the sun rise from the night past where I went to started to write, it was one of those deals where arduous, no, I would say almost death-defying these last 10 years, and I wouldn't trade it for anything because I met these people. I had a chance to talk with these people. These people, the North Georgia folks that were involved with this story. And it was the most magnificent journey I've ever taken, but it broke my heart. It still does, and it's very difficult. In fact, the book is out now. Of course, it's been out for 4 months. It was released 4 months ago. And I will talk with the family members. They'll call me. I gave them all copies of the book, and they said, Tony, I cannot read it without crying. And once I start crying, I know I'm not going to be able to stop if I keep reading, so I've had to put the book down. And there are several of the remaining family members of the officers that tell me that. And though it breaks my heart, my intent was not to bring back these memories. I feel a bit of gratitude because, after all, I did what they told me to do. Write the story, all the bullet wounds and all. Don't leave anything out, including the language, because that's the way this story unfolded. And it was it was just incredible what these folks allowed me to do and how they accepted me. And the sad part lingers on, because in this journey of 10 years that I started 45 years after the crime, I've had to attend several of these folks' funerals. And when they have a funeral, somebody will mention, if not several of the old folk here in North Georgia will mention that incident involving those three, and that these folks were kin or relatives, still wives, still daughters-in-laws, still moms. And it would just tear everybody up in attendance. And those kind of hurt, you just can't wipe those out of your heart. But what is amazing to me, and what is helping my healing process, number one, the folks I met and the memories we've got. Number two is folks like Dan. You know, it to me, if you want to give me a shout out because you enjoyed the book, that is something that I really, really take great deal of pleasure in. These officers, Dan, are not going to be forgotten. 2 years ago, before the book was published, they were on the verge of being forgotten. Now their memory is actually training law enforcement agencies through the book Ark Road. My publisher, Genius Book Publishing, and I are donating 10% of all proceeds from all things matter to Ark Road to the American Police Hall of Fame Memorial and Museum down in Titusville, Florida. With that donation, the National Association of Chiefs of Police, who run the museum down there, are able to take Ark Road and travel the country, teaching new recruits and recurring training for seasoned officers how to get out of handcuffs, how to get a guy back under your control who's already taken your weapon, things of that nature. So the memories of these officers, in fact, the images of these officers, are going on now full throttle as they teach tactics, tactics they were never taught, and as now that the tactics are being taught as a result of Art Road, I cannot express to you or your audience the pride I feel that these three officers' memories are going on, and they will continue to go on. These families need that. They deserve that. And these three officers are wonderful people. They live amongst us still. And to that end, the museum and memorial in Titusville, Florida. There in the middle of the museum is a rotunda. The rotunda has marble walls throughout. Those walls are inscribed into those walls are the names of over 9,000 police officers who died in the line of duty. And those names are still added, and they're still added. And what those officers on those walls do is they can literally, if you'll listen, they can talk to today's modern police officer. And they can tell them about their experiences, and they ask them questions such as, if given the same set of circumstances that was presented to me on that particular night, described as my end of watch, with all your tools, with all your training, with all your skills, would the outcome be any different for you than it was for us? And those names on those walls still talk. A lot of lessons to be learned. I've gotten off, and I'm not plugging I am plugging the museum. It's a wonderful place in Titusville, Florida, and every family needs to go down there. It's a great learning experience and a real eye-opener as well.
You talked about the kinds of things that the police recruits now have learned from the Ark Road case, and it's helping officers now to avoid a similar fate in the future. As you write in the end of the book, from the two trials and from the information that was provided by Wade Truitt, with incredible pressure from and visual help and aid from Robert Hightower to scare the hell out of Wade Truitt. But that being said, Wade Truitt, he believed in his innocence as opposed to Evans and Williams, but especially Evans.
Robert Hightower told me that.
Sorry, as you write in the book, what are the kinds of things, what are the things that happened that fateful night when this trio was stealing a car, switching plates? Tell us what happened and what mistakes, fateful mistakes. We talked about, you mentioned the Derringer that Jerry Everett had, but wasn't loaded. Tell us what happened. Incredibly, through the Robert Hightower in this investigation, they got to the every single graphic detail of what happened to these police officers. Tell us what happened.
That is a great question, because that was the unknown. We had to take the autopsy reports and start following bullet trajectories through these three officers to understand how it could have happened. When I first saw the crime scene photographs, Mr. Gravett and Jerry Everett were lying face down, yet both had been shot in the front of the face. The speculation was that they had just marched them into the woods and executed them from behind, but that's as far as from the truth as can be. They did put up a struggle. What happened that night was a lesson for every patrol officer out there to learn, and not just learn, but practice. They let their guard down in several ways. And again, the family said, if that's the what happened, you tell it that way. They let their guard down. Yes, Jerry didn't reload his Derringer. Had Jerry reloaded his Derringer before they got back into the car, he would have placed it into the side of Alec Evans' ear, pulled the trigger, and you and I would not be on the phone right now. That was altogether a different story about just that. But now it starts to add up, and those stars and those planets starting to get into the improper alignment. Jerry then, at that scene, did all the things that an untrained officer would do, but today's trained officer would never do. One of the things he did was he left himself alone in the dirt road when Truett got in his Chevy, which was called the getaway car, and tried to get off of Ark Road going backwards. I spoke about the condition of the road was terrible. So you can see it and picture it and hear it and smell it. Here he is in his 62 Chevy Impala convertible trying to evade the police, elude the police, by going backwards. They had come in from the other end of Ark Road, so they were facing him, and they simply followed him into A.C. Mills' driveway. It was the only driveway they could have followed him. But now here's where, again, everything starts going wrong. Mr. Gravett, Officer Davis, did not handcuff Truett when they boxed him into the front of Mills' house. They saw he was wearing, as were all the culprits that night, a pair of white cotton gloves. Police cars at that time didn't have cages in the back. Police officers didn't have security straps on their holsters. Police officers just had what they felt was a degree of respect from the community that really didn't exist. So, again, their car didn't have, their patrol car didn't have a protective cage between the front and the back seat. They didn't handcuff the culprits back then or the suspects. They just played the game very nonchalantly, and because of that, they returned back up Ark's Hill to where the stolen Oldsmobile, Vincent and Alec Evans, were in. And Jerry Everett was there all alone after the other two officers left the scene in pursuit of one of the bad guys. And he did something that no police officer can afford to do, especially in this day and time. He turned his back to Alec Evans, who was a desperate criminal himself. He already knew he was going to prison for 2 years, and now he's been caught by, of all things, his old friend, Officer Jerry Everett, stealing a car, red-handed. So he did not want to go to prison any longer. Back in those days, a stolen car gets you 2 years in the pen. Not a big deal. Probably get out in 12 months. Anyway, so Alex was selfish that night. He was always selfish. He did not want to go back to prison. So he carried a .38 snubby in his waist. And when Jerry Everett turned his back on Alex, Alex stuck that snubby in his back and took his gun. And that was the most horrendous mistake of all. Jerry Everett was the most seasoned cop of the three that night. And Jerry Everett was no pushover. As I explained, he was a blue cat. You best not want to mess with. Jerry Everett was a good cop, and he knew how to get himself out of the trouble that he would so often get himself into. But he turned his back. So now we've got three major issues. Number one is he didn't load the Derringer. Number two, he didn't follow what would have been considered procedure now. He let the other two officers go. It was pitch black at night on this hill, and he didn't do anything to protect himself correct that night. But when he turned his back, Alex Evans stole his gun, picked his gun out, placed it in his back and told him, don't do anything stupid. And the next thing you know is Jerry naturally is going to do an elbow, flying elbow to the back of Evans, knocked him down. But in that process, Alex discharged his .38 and shot him in the leg, and that began the carnage. From that point on, the other officers came back with Truett after having caught him down the road. They came back. Jerry and Evans were in the car. Jerry now was having his very own gun pointed at the side of his head by Alex Evans, and also knew that Evans was crazy enough to do something even more felonious than what he'd gotten himself into up until that point. So it was a series of accidents, but the biggest problem that you've got that night is when Alex held that gun to Jerry Everett's head, he told the other two officers, Ralph Davis and Jesse Gravett, to hand over their guns, and they did. I actually had Jerry Everett's oldest brother, George Everett, who was in law enforcement, and several of his brothers were, and he looked at me and he said, Tony, why on earth would you have given your gun up that night on that dirt road? That's all you had. And that was the moment that turned everything around against the police and against the county that night. They handed over their guns, and as George Everett told me, if the shooting starts, you got to have a gun to keep it going. And they had given up their guns, those officers. They were frightened that Jerry Everett, the toughie on that police force, was without his gun and his in possession of, and yet the bad guy who they knew was holding it against his head. So they did as he said. And Jerry, I'm sure at that point in time, was, oh, we're in it now. We're up to our knees in this trouble, and it's only going to get worse, which, of course, it did. So they made a series of acts of moves that at the time didn't seem like it would be that bad. But you add them all up, and you get three county police officers lying face down in the woods.
As you write in the book, what is the ultimate motive for the murders, and as horrific as they are, five shots, six shots in the face, close. And these are friends, apparently, of his. So what pushes him over the edge? He's a psychopath, as we mentioned in the introduction, especially his behavior after the murders. But what is it that pushes him over the edge that surprises everyone?
What is it that pushes any murderer over the edge? I wished I knew. In this case, though, so the question is too deep for me to answer accurately. I'm just not. But Alex Evans was a different kind of a person. I have asked that question myself to many people. The first question that I asked when I started the journey was, you knew Alex Evans, and whoever I would be discussing with, yes, I did. My first question after that would be, was he capable? And Dan, before I could get it out of my mouth, virtually everybody I talked to, we're talking 50, 60, 70 people, I lost track, would say absolutely he was capable. What would motivate him to do that? Well, in a way, selfishness, greed, whatever all those emotions can amount to, he had those that night. He just didn't want anything to come about. Alex thought highly of only one guy, and that was the guy he saw in the mirror every morning he woke up. He did not want to come up with anything. I think as I look into it, he didn't want his friends, his circle of people, to know that he had been arrested for stealing a car. I think he wanted to keep that out of the public domain, the notion that he would, because he was arrogant and he had an ego as if he was really something in the county, that people looked up to him and admired him. And he didn't want to taint or destroy that image of himself, perhaps. Little did he know, because people like that won't allow it in. But little did he know his reputation had already soured years ago. And those folks in the county that knew him, and there were a bunch, knew that he was capable of doing bad things. They just didn't know he was capable of doing something like this. But if you ask Alec that very same question, he's not going to answer it. He's going to deny it, anything of it, to have anything of it. So you carry that on for the rest of his life. After 53 years, he finally passed away in a Georgia state prison, mostly out of his mind, eaten up with every disease in the book. Nothing ever good came about Alex. He was a wasted fella all his life. He wasted other people's lives too. But there's no answer to what caused it. It could have been anger. It could have been jealousy. It could have been any number of things on that dirt road that night. I don't think that Alex understood or realized he was capable of doing that even after he did it. I think that Alex was unaware that he was a murderer until he actually blew Jerry's brains out in the back of that stolen Oldsmobile. I don't think that he gave it any thought. I know for a fact he didn't give it a whole lot of thought for a half a century afterwards that he was capable of doing something like that. Yet we had an eyewitness to the crime, and we had other people whose opinions all shared, do come up to a certain sum that goes against Alec, that's for sure. But I don't think he could answer that question. I can't answer that question. I hope to God I never will be able to answer a question like that or have need to.
What I really meant was is that the language that you provide is that Jerry Everett was incredulous. That's why he let his guard down. He knew Evans. He didn't believe, as you described, he didn't believe he was in danger. They were unprepared for something like this. It's unprecedented in their career, even though they're a tough guy. So
you're
what
right.
I meant by that is that the police were defiant. That bleeding officer, Everett, was defiant. He wasn't, because Evans was proposing that they just cover this up, say it was an accident when the other cops came back. So that's not a good reason, but.
Yeah, no. There is no good reason to take the lives of three friends, let alone three county police officers. There is no good reason. But you're right. Jerry Everett stayed defiant. Jerry Everett was the take control kind of guy. And Jerry Everett caused a fuss in that Oldsmobile. And I think the shooting started because it was a result of his action and because he had been telling Evans all along. Evans had him under control, and they handcuffed these three officers right there at the scene where they gave their guns up. They put them in the stolen Oldsmobile and drove over the hill. Alex was still, I think, stinging from the fact that Jerry kept mentioning to him, you're going to go to jail for a long time, brother, and you're doing something like this, you're shackling, or I should say you're bounding three people together, you're kidnapping them, you're moving them off site, you've already shot me in my leg, you're going to prison for a long, long time. And I think Alex, just at the thought of that, kept fuming and kept getting madder and madder and madder. And then finally he just broke. But yes, Jerry Everett stayed most defiant throughout all of that, and he would have been. Jerry Everett was a lawman, and when the law was being broken in front of him and to him, I think it probably would have gotten his ire up more than just about anything you could have done to him.
Absolutely. The other thing, too, the evidence of the psychopathic nature of this killer and his arrogance and his narcissism are that after, in these cops that want somebody to pay, he is approaching them saying, listen, I've undertaken an investigation. Some of the families want me to investigate as I was, adding beyond insult to injury. But this is the kind of psychopathic mind that this guy had. Did he think he could fool these police veterans, but meanwhile taunting them, basically, over the murder of their three comrades?
Imagine these three officers back in the day out here in the country. Funerals were held in their homes. These three police officers were brought back to their homes so folks could come in and pay their respect, their last respect. Their three caskets were open caskets.
Incredible.
The carnage done to their faces. I heard family members as I sat in the very spot where Jerry Everett, for instance, lay in his casket. Right in the very spot, I had the Everett people tell me, Tony, we would look at him and we would all ask, are you sure God in heaven has made a mistake? That couldn't possibly be Jerry, because his face was completely black and blue and full of patches of skin gone. He was shot four times in his head, two other places on his body, but four times in the back of his head after he died, as were the others. Ralph Davis was shot. He laid on his back in the woods, and he was shot five times in his mouth. The gun was put in his mouth. Blew his teeth all over the woods. Jesse Gravett, in defiance, was shot in his right eye. The barrel of the gun was placed in his right eye, and the trigger was pulled there. These three officers' wakes lasted for a day and a half at their homes. Not any one of those three, their facial identification or how people would recognize them was recognizable. You couldn't tell what was in that casket. People questioned that all throughout. The idea of Alex Evans coming to their homes and sitting in the very kitchen tables that I sat in, those many years ago, he would come in and say, I'm going to help find who did that to your son. But the irony there was Alex Evans, though he was available, never came to one single funeral at any time. There were lawmen looking for him because their suspicions were up. Small county, small people. But he never showed up to any of their funerals, yet 2 weeks later, he started making the rounds to their homes, explaining that he was going to solve this crime because there was no one in Gwinnett that could, and if they had any leads to give him, he would sure appreciate it. So it was unbelievable, and I heard family members for the better part of the 10 years that I would visit with them. They would point at the very seat he sat in and say, he sat right there and looked right into my damn face and said he was going to investigate and find out who did this to Jerry or Jesse or Ralph. And that was unbelievable that you would have that kind of gall. Goes back to your other question. What would motivate? What would cause somebody to erupt enough to fire 19 total shots, 16 of which found their mark, and then come back 2 weeks later after the funerals and explain to the families that he was going to investigate that crime? Is beyond belief. It is something that, you know, some people can get through life just bumping down the road, and some people go through their lives thinking that everybody else is stupid, and that's what Alec Evans thought. He could schmooze these people over, but every one of them, to a person, told me the day he came in, we knew he was going to lie, then he left. We knew he had lied. We were kept asking the police, lock him up. He's the guy that did it. But they couldn't. They had nothing against Alec at the time in order to do that. And in fact, again, if it wasn't for Truett, Alec would have walked free.
It's interesting you talk about that the police found out that respect didn't carry as completely as far as they thought, but in the investigation all along the way, people with criminal records and not wanting to be a snitch felt it necessary to give the police information. The police might have said, listen, you're going to give me, boy, some information, but they still seemed out of conscience, were more than willing to put information about Evans and Williams to put this whole case together. So there was, it seemed to me, huge support, even from the criminal class, that this was beyond the pale, this was not to be tolerated at all in this county.
You have just summed it up beautifully, and that was the case. Folks were scared. After this happened, we just little old law-abiding Gwinnettians here in North Georgia were frightened to death. We didn't have any idea who could have done this. Is it a marauding gang? They then initially said it's because there was a connection with the stolen car and a report of such that they thought, but who on earth could have done it? The people that felt it was Evans knew, but the other two, they had no idea. And so as a result, folks were frightened. They would give up their own mother if they thought she was capable of doing this kind of thing. It was horrendous, and it's what people woke up to in their hearts in the morning, and it's what they went to bed at night in their fears. They just couldn't get rid of this story, and it was so brutal that actually they tried to sweep it up under the carpet even after it was said and done, but by that time the damage had been done and the county had been forever affected by these murders. But it was something, Dan, that it was just so horribly sad for people that they would gladly do whatever necessary to catch these people that did it. And at the two co-trials, 18 months after the crime, people rejoiced beyond what you could imagine now when the convictions were brought. It was a time of holiday because in their hearts and in their minds, they felt they had finally taken care of all of that ugly notoriety by getting something good out of this thing, and that's a conviction for two felons. And at the time, they were given, without any hesitation by the judge or jury, they were given death sentences. They were scheduled to be in the electric chair, but the federal Supreme Court had different thoughts about capital punishment at the time, so that both their sentences were commuted, not just to life, but to life with the possibility of parole. And in fact, Vincent Williams was paroled 25 years later, and he came out of the deal with the families in mind, I'm sure. But the gate, reporters at the gate asked him, "Vincent, tell us about that horrible night 25 years ago." And he looked at the reporters and he addressed them and he said, "I shall never talk about that night 25 years ago, but rather thank the good Lord for any days he sees fit in giving me in the future."
What I thought most interesting, and before I let you go, I wanted to mention this in the book. It's very interesting when the DA, I believe it's Reed Merritt, is cross-examining, I believe, Williams' wife. And despite all of this evidence from Wade Truitt, she still maintained that her husband never left that house that night. Isn't that true?
It was Mr. Merritt that was on his direct. He had asked Alec Evans' wife to take the stand.
Pardon me.
But in her case, she answered truthfully. And her final answer to the question, "Was Alec home all night that night?" she said, "I couldn't say for certain." So, and they also questioned his son and said, "Was your dad at home that night, all night?" And his son said, "To be honest with you, I don't know." And that's, you know, Alex was a cat of the night. And so I'm sure he frequently left the house. But Jewel Evans was a wonderful, wonderful lady. She was very well admired by several of the folks in the county, many of the folks in the county. She was a churchgoer, as folks were. But after this crime, she was not the same. And her life had been destroyed. And if you look at all of what it is, the jury in that day and time said, "We're not here to prosecute her." And the prosecutor said, "No, we're not. We're not going to throw hardball questions. All we wanted to hear was she didn't know truthfully if he was home all night that night. She supposed he was, and in fact, she claimed they slept in the same bed. But when the final question was asked, she said, "I don't know." Jewel Evans, Alec Evans' wife, as well as Vincent Williams' wife and family, and Wade Truitt's demise was very dramatic himself not long after this, these people's lives were ruined too. So there were so many people that not just with broken hearts and for the county broken spirits, but for those who were incriminated one way or another, the county was just the foundation, the bedrock of our county was tainted in ways differently to a lot of people, but tainted nonetheless.
Absolutely. You write in the book that the very first day for police recruits, if I'm not correct, is that they go where and experience what?
It was John Crunkleton, for his successful investigation of this crime. And Detective Crunkleton was with DeKalb County again. He was heading up their vice department. He was appointed by the new band of commissioners that came in Gwinnett shortly after this crime as Gwinnett County Police Chief. He held that position as the longest-serving police chief in the county's history still to this day. But Mr. Crunkleton had some pretty hardball things because he remembered this crime. You only need see the headlines, or you only need think about the carnage done that day, just indirectly, to understand how hard and fast it's going to stick in your mind, this kind of brutality, this kind of horror. But Mr. Crunkleton would, after he became chief of Gwinnett County Police Department, all new recruits, and they've certainly trained about this incident and they study this incident, though many of the today police officers with Gwinnett County have told me it's always dangled out there. But we never knew what happened until Ark Road, the book, came along. But Mr. Crunkleton would see to it that their first night on duty after being certified a police officer and after having extensive training, because he brought in the combative training element aspect of the new recruits in Gwinnett County, he would have them, their partners, drive them to Ark Road, open the door and say, "It's yours, I'll meet you on the other side." He would do that after midnight on their first shift, and they were to walk that road, again, dark as can be. A flashlight isn't going to be that helpful back in the day. The poor condition or the poor quality of flashlights and the darkness of that road. And he would make them walk that road. And where the three officers' bodies were found lying in the woods, he would have them engrave or inscribe their initials on a big oak tree that was right there at the beginning of the little wagon trail leading to where the bodies were found. And then they would do that, and then they would walk the other side of Ark Road for over a mile and a half, still in the dark. And I had heard several of them say they don't know if they'd ever been more scared in all their lives than that night they had to walk down Ark Road.
Yes. I want to thank you, Tony Tiffin, for coming on and talking about Ark Road, the horrific murders of three police officers in Gwinnett County, Georgia, that changed law enforcement forever. It's been absolutely fascinating, Tony. I know this is a Genius publishing book under their publishing company. Is there any other way that people might find out about this book? Do you have a Facebook page or website, or is it just Amazon and check it out?
I would suggest, thanks for asking, Dan, I would suggest, and I'm proud of this work. It tells the truth. It's a story that folks need to hear, so I don't mind recommending this book. You're going to love it. You're going to enjoy the read. You're going to find that this is a horrendous story, but out of it came a rock-solid sense of love by this county, given to us as a gift by the families of these three officers in appreciation for the outpouring of grief we showed for those three officers' families and still do to this day. Ark Road is a love story, but you are going to enjoy the read, and you can get it on Amazon.com, of course. Locally here, we can get it through Barnes & Noble and certain sites like that. But that's your best bet. You can just go to Amazon and grab it, and there she'll be.
Thank you very much, Tony. You have a great evening. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you for Ark Road.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
Good night.